Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. Well, it's very nice to be back. I actually haven't had much time to put a few thoughts together. So I was only asked to give this talk about half an hour before the puja started. I could hear someone was knocking on my door. I thought, I don't usually hear anyone outside. How long were you standing outside my kuti? Were you? So I thought I'd just start by talking about how my time in Devon was, and allow that the talk to develop from there. So I got away on the 18th of December, just before the snow set in. So I felt that was quite a good quite good timing, quite a good move to make. Even though you could say you were all given the opportunity to be in solitude here, I found it very beneficial to make the effort to go away to a different location and to really to enjoy some real physical seclusion. So Devon, for those of you who don't know about the place, the Devon Vihara is a cottage about 4 miles from Honiton, and the estate comprises about 20 acres of field, mostly on a hillside, and a few meditation huts, affording simple living with wood-burning stoves. And for me, one of the features I particularly appreciated was the real sense of living close to the elements. And over time, noticing the effect of living a different pace had on my whole sense of groundedness and well-being. Visitors to Amaravati might think, peaceful place, good place to be. Okay, if you come from the city, Amaravati is a place that represents and symbolizes and allows you to enjoy a sense of calm, immense space, maybe spaciousness, peace of mind. But if you live here as a resident or a lay person for a month or two, you'll soon realize, it's quite a complex place to be, actually. If you have anything, if you live here and you're participating in community, there can be many demands placed on us. It's like we're all crew members here. There are no passengers. It takes a fair bit of work just to stay here. There are all sorts of committees and meetings that take place to coordinate who does what and to create a sense of order. All I'm saying, it's a comparative thing. If you're coming from London, from the outside, and just visiting to Amaravati, you might think, this is a nice place, a very peaceful place to be. But if you live here, if you're not careful, one can get caught up in complexities and inevitably finding yourself hitting up against difficulties with getting along with people. And not to say that this means things are going wrong in the community. That's what community is about, learning through difficulties. For me, making the effort to get away from all these difficulties, to putting down the complexities and all the demands that I can feel placed on me. So this was my great escape for a while. So I felt quite pleased to be making my move. Especially, of course, as most of you have forgotten, I asked especially to get away on the 18th of December, because 3 days later was going to be the 21st of December, remember? Well, yeah. And most of you have forgotten. Well, nothing obvious happened. It doesn't mean to say it's not going to happen. There we are. I just thought I'd get that one out of the way. And also, I should mention, they got the year wrong, you see. It was just one more year later. Well, that's just, I could give you a few other excuses, but. So, I'm emphasizing my appreciation of getting away to Devon, living close to the elements, living a life of relative simplicity. Like all places, there's always something that gets at you. Devon's very wet, and I had to walk across this very muddy, slippery field every morning and every evening. In the first 6 weeks of the winter retreat, I had to make it a practice, actually, walking across the field. Because if I wasn't careful, I would slip. I did fall right into it a couple of times. But it's just that the pathway up to the pond, there's a pond in the middle of this field on the hillside, the pathway is at a very slight incline, but whenever this ground gets wet, even an incline of 5 degrees is enough to make you feel very insecure. And 5 degrees can tip you over, the slime on the top. It's really quite remarkable how you feel that insecurity in your body. And if you're not careful, it becomes a source of great annoyance. And so whenever I found myself walking across this marshy field, I really made it a practice just to be with each step and not to be too anxious about getting across in the mornings, to getting across to the house to be there in time for breakfast. My practice was simply to be with each step. Later, I developed this practice to this whole theme of becoming, because like with any path, even this spiritual path, we can be anxious about getting somewhere, about getting results from our practice. And I don't know about you, but I notice in myself, I notice whenever I have doubts about, well, where my practice has taken me, I always find it helpful to remember, well, that essentially that my practice has always taken me to this present, to how we receive, how we relate to this present. And so that was very evident to me each time I found myself having to traverse this insecure, muddy pathway. Now, as with all difficulties, all hardships, all problems, we can either make it a practice to be patient and bear with that, or we can, make an effort to remedy it. And In this case, I decided I would patiently get a barrow of grit and gravel and stones and make this pathway more easy to get across. Not just for myself, but I made it a practice of offering something for future retreatants. So anyway, I'm not asking you to put out a memorial stone and say, oh, Gandhasena made this path. But anyway, again, I was just making that as a practice. And it's quite difficult, actually, even pushing a wheelbarrow over a slippery field. But I made that to my practice, without being too anxious about getting the job finished or anxious about the result. And so in my time there, I must have pushed getting on to 100 barrows of stones and gravel. Looking at it, you might not think it was 100, but I can assure you it was. So I found that quite... that's the outcome of my retreat, actually. Practice without being too anxious about the outcome, just willing to apply oneself patiently to what I was doing in the present. Also, I found that having some physical work to do was really good, because well, for me, I find it's essential to remain grounded, otherwise this practice can become all really quite heady. And again, this comes to a theme I wanted to touch on, you know, the balancing the head and the heart. Because, it seems to me that, it seems to me we can have so many ideas. We can be inspired by concepts of Buddhist practice. But if we want to really build a practice that's going to carry us over many years, we also have to develop the heart, and the heart is in the body. I see it as to develop the heart is to embody the teachings, to actualize, to realize the qualities that are helpful, not just as an idea, but to make them very real and tangible, something that we can experience as a feeling in the body, something that's very real. So those qualities that I'm getting at are such qualities as patience, as well-being, not just for oneself, but for others, a genuine interest for the welfare of others. And that's quite useful, worthwhile to develop, because that helps us get out of our preoccupation with ourselves. Have you noticed how when we get caught up in our preoccupation with ourselves, how limiting that is, our problems, or my problems, and mind you can get caught up with other people's problems, but to develop a genuine sense of well-being, for others, it's a means of getting one's attention directed outwards, and then also we can take delight in the success or the well-being of others. I see this is something that if we wish to thrive in community, it's a skill we all eventually have to discover and see the benefits. I spent the first 4 weeks of my retreat time thinking about this monastery and all the problems that I felt I needed to sort out in my head. Well, actually, I wasn't consciously thinking about the place, but it's just I found myself doing that. And then at the end of 4 weeks, I just told myself, oh, I've had enough of this. I see now it's not the real Amravati. It's something that I'm creating in my own mind. All the ideas that I had, the memories of, scenarios of I said something and then he said something really strange and then I laughed and then he was angry. And I couldn't work out what was going on. And so then, I go back to my meditation hut and then try and work out what happened and what went wrong, and scenarios like this, and it's endless. You never really come to much understanding that way. So it was a great relief after 4 weeks for me to finally realize, oh, this isn't the real Amravati, it's something that I'm creating in my own mind, and that helped. And then I gave myself permission to be happy where I was, because I wasn't going to get happiness by thinking about this place. Now, that doesn't mean Amravati is a miserable place to be. It just means the creations of my mind, what I was creating about around this place, wasn't the way to contentment. It wasn't going to lead to any upliftment of mind. So you might think, oh, Gandhisena wasted a whole month being unhappy, being miserable. Well, yes, and no. I came to see how when we, the way we see our own suffering can, the way we see our own suffering can be transformative, because the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness that we create, when we see we're creating it, it can then become a source of understanding, a source of wisdom. And I find that helpful to be reminded of, because if we're not careful, we can take this path and teaching as a way of getting rid of unsatisfactoriness, to getting rid of unhappiness, for getting rid of discontent. But if we look upon the experience of suffering as an opportunity, then that transforms our outlook completely. If we feel helpless, certainly if we feel helpless with our suffering, we can become very stuck. But I see this is what the path is taught in the Eightfold, as in the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, the way out of suffering. The path indicates what factors we need to develop to gain insight into our own character, insight into our own minds, the way our minds work. So coming back to the theme of being close to the elements, I'm sure I've said before in previous talks about not to overlook the supportive vitalities of nature, not to overlook the value of being with trees, living close to the earth. There are so many gadgets, electronic devices and visual impingements that distract us. At first they can seem useful, purposeful, and like the computer, objects of convenience and instant communication. And then, but I think most of you find when you work with these devices again and again, you know, this technology of convenience can become an inconvenience, a source of annoyance. Technology doesn't always work. In the early days of emails, I can remember one of the monks was saying one of the traps of setting up an email account is first of all you're unaware, you're getting drawn into a trap. It's like, it seems so convenient to be able to communicate with other people halfway around the world instantaneously. But then, of course, as soon as you send an email, you get one back, which needs to be answered again. And then one thing leads to another, then you get a wide circle of friends, and then it's like each day, maybe sending about 10 emails a day. And then, of course, you know what that means. There'll be 10 replies and more emails to be sent. So technology is all very well, but we have to develop some discipline So over the years, I've developed this trick of waiting for a few days. So now you know why I'm not responding to some of your emails. Because I know it's endless, you know. Yeah. If you send an email, you've got to reply to one. You're going to get a reply that will need another send. And so it is that we have new occupational hazards. What do they call that? Occupational medical problems, where you know people work at keyboards and then the fingers start to get strange symptoms. So there we are, contrasting getting involved with communications and modern technology, returning to a simple pace of living close to the earth. Now, because I stayed in my kuti until breakfast time each morning, I could eventually actually feel the earth coming to life. I didn't have to pull up my blinds to see the sun coming up, or even if the clouds was heavy in the valley. I wouldn't have to look at my watch or see how much light was coming through the windows. I could feel the vitality, the energy of the earth rising just as the sun was coming up. I'm not saying this is a special skill, but I was quite surprised. I could feel like my body was resonating with the earth. I felt that connected. And that energy rose in accordance with the sun. It wasn't a specific time each day, it was with the sun, not by the clock. So I found that really quite reassuring and very grounding. Reminding myself that this body is earth, and so I felt very connected. So I found that very interesting. It was particularly when the sun came up, it was just coming up over the horizon, that the earth seemed to be most vibrant. So that connection with the earth energies, I found, allowed me to experience myself the embodiment of myself, and that I found helped me to be present. Now the body is where we feel, so. Developing this quality of the presence in the body, to be embodied, is very valuable. This is a way of developing calm, some equanimity, to be really present with our feelings. Without having to think or analyze or add any more or to it. I found that immensely peaceful, very, very calming. And again, going down to stand by the pond with the oak trees and connect with the vitality of the trees. Because there wasn't much going on, there was no work organized, well, I had plenty of time just to stand still with the trees. So I found, aside from walking across the field, instead of doing walking meditation, this formal walking meditation, as a complement to sitting, I found myself investing the time in being with the trees. You see again and again in the suttas, the Buddha encouraging the monks to sit at the foot of trees after having gone to the village and collected his food for the day. In the opening preamble to the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Buddha it says that the monk goes to the foot of a tree and sets up mindfulness before him. Now, if our retreat times are going to be of any real use to us, what is it for each of you? What is it that you can carry over? What is it that stays with you? What is it that you've developed? What is it that you have appreciated? What is it that you can bring to this moment now as we get more engaged with having to organize and become more active, having to engage with others? If we just use a time of relative solitude as a way of developing samadhi or getting high or just developing calm or just developing one facet of the path, is it something, is it a quality that we can bring to bear in this moment? And this moment? So for me, one of the things I'm particularly mindful of now, having got back, and I'm I'm cautious about allowing my attention to get caught up in what's changed here, what's happened, what did people say, what's wrong here. I'm very cautious about how my mind becomes engaged with assessing with what I see or hear as pleasing or disagreeable. Because I know that's my tendency of mind to easily get drawn out and caught up in the qualities, the various qualities of things that we see and hear people talking about. So I've been here, I've just got back about 2 days, I think. Is that right? 2 days. And I know I've got next week, I know I've got rooms to plan and organize for all these very important elders are coming from other monasteries and various visitors, and got to juggle so many rooms to allow to fit everyone in. And got to remember who's coming in and going. And I've got 4 or 5 emails of people who want to plant trees and scatter ashes. And very, very easy to get caught up in, for me, to get caught up in ideas of, oh, well, I'd rather not be bothered with all these complexities. Instead, what I find far better for me to be mindful of is my the center within here, so to speak, to pay attention to my center, so my embodied center. And so, and that for me is the heart. Not the mind, because that the mind, for me, is a very cerebral thing, and I don't actually think of myself as a very cerebral type. I mean, there are more cerebral types here. You know, it's not an insult if I say you're more cerebral than me. I mean, you know, some of you got greater abilities. You know, some people can chant the Patimokkha. You've got different abilities, and some people can got vast capacities for memorizing things and great intellectual capacities for giving very entertaining talks. Anyway. The point I want to emphasize here is, however our retreat time has been for us, what of the qualities that we've nurtured or developed or given attention to during that time of solitude, can we bring that to bear to this moment, each moment? Because I ask that question because it seems to me if our practice, you know, if the fruits of our practice, you know, can't manifest in the daily moment-to-moment activities, then we're not really reaping, and we're not making the most of our practice. It has to be, well, as I say, it has to be real. I have to make it. If it's not, if we can't manifest qualities, the qualities that we're developing in our ordinary daily life, then what are we doing? In the Christian teaching, there's this saying, you know, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven. Now, I'm not trying to convert you. I'm not saying Buddhism's no good. But that saying, the encouragement to seek the kingdom of heaven within, and then all things follow from that, all good things will come to you. That's what that saying is about. I find that very, very useful to recollect, because we can easily overlook how it's the quality of heart that we bring to monastic life that affects profoundly, you know, how we perceive what happens to us, what happens in our lives here. If we continually feel like we're victims, helpless victims of circumstance, then naturally we'll eventually be packing our bags and getting out of here. But if we learn to take responsibility for we learn to take more responsibility for our lives and see that we're not helpless beings, that we can develop ourselves, we can develop our minds, we can develop more uplifting qualities of mind that allow carries us through all the hardships and difficulties. So this is 2013, and for me that means that it was 10 years since I last visited Devon. And if I think now of all the difficulties and hardships that I'd got through, I could either make a big story out of it, make a sorrowful tale, and there certainly were moments when I wondered where my life was going. But I'm pleased to say that my attitude has completely turned around, and I can say that I find it extraordinary how, you know, if I hadn't suffered through all these hardships, I would never have benefited from so many good things that have come to me. So I'm delighted to say that I can be grateful for all the suffering that I've had to put up with. So in closing, I do hope you all come to I appreciate the opportunity that's offered to us when we see the, when we experience a sign of suffering, because it means then it's the sign that says, ah, our practice needs to be developed just a little bit more. Doesn't mean it, that everything's wrong and all our practice has been fruitless. Just to note how we view that sign of dukkha depends on whether that remains the dukkha that leads to more dukkha, or if it becomes the dukkha that leads to wisdom. Okay, that'll be a good note to sign off, I think. So thank you for your patience.